Before we get into it, though, let's just update. I want to update on what you guys are working on. So, Will, what are you working on?
I feel like it's going to be the same a lot. I've still got the Bonaparte sequel. And
yeah, how's that coming?
I've sent in my sketches and waiting to hear back. Uh-huh. And I liked it. It's got a lot of fun action in it. So we'll see. And then I'm also working on a board game. It's not a boring game. It's a board game.
Why did you take the board game project?
Why did I take that? It's a game.
Because you've always wanted to work on a game.
Well, I've worked on several games before, but this one, it's all about teaching kids different emotions, uh-huh. And I love.
Is it done in your pencil?
No,
style?
It's in my paint, my digital painting style. So, it's pretty straightforward, but it's every emotion you can possibly imagine, and I think the kids are going to have to try to, you know, like look at the cards and then guess the emotion, and it's just a fun challenge to try to capture, you know, like what is the essence of this particular emotion.
Yeah.
Trying to get it in one illustration and just, you know,
so for you taking on this project was it was something a little bit different. It was a little more challenging, and B, I assume the money's okay.
Yeah. This money's definitely not great on this one, but the art, you know, I worked with the art director and said, will I get creative freedom? That's the only way I can do it for the budget that you're working on. And he said, yeah, he's not going to hassle me. So it's really up to, I'm basically playing art director as well.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Sometimes that's, you know, sometimes having the creative freedom is like the worst thing.
Yeah.
But I feel like watching you work on this, I feel like you're having fun with it.
Yeah.
Cool. Lee.
I haven't seen any of that work. I want you to send me some of it.
I'll send you some.
I need to see it so I can comment, give you my feedback.
What are you working on, Lee?
I have just moved across this great country of ours. I stopped in Utah and Colorado and Kansas as quick as I could get through Kansas. I did. No offense to anyone living in Kansas.
You started in Portland, right?
Portland, Oregon. Yep. And so now I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. So I'm just getting set up my studio. I set up my monitor today, and I'm working on two books, one that I am writing and illustrating myself, and then another one. We're working on the details of the deal for one that someone else wrote that I may illustrate. And so kind of just getting set up for the next phase.
Mm, cool.
So now you grew up in Tennessee, though, right?
Yep. Native Nashvillian.
You lost your accent about when?
It's coming back.
You've heard that you can never go home, right?
What does that mean?
I've never heard that. It's like a literary thing. You can never go home, meaning you can never, going home will never feel the same. It's like,
as we say in the South, can't never could do nothing.
It's like in the hero's journey, like Frodo, when he went back, right? It was different. He's like, what did he say? He's like, what was his line, Jake? You know these lines.
I can't remember. I just keep thinking about that giant pumpkin that the guy brings in. He's showing off this massive pumpkin.
Yeah.
And anybody cares about is the pumpkin.
Right.
When these four guys just saved their lives, you know. Right.
And that's the thing, is that you're changed. The idea of the hero's journey is you're changed forever, so you'll never experience home like it was before.
Well, I will say this, that if it was like it was before... there was a reason.
Yeah, maybe you're
not
a hero if it's the same, right?
I don't want it to be the same because it sucked when I was here before. And now Nashville has come a long, long, long way in the past 20 years. Very progressive compared to what it was when I was here growing up. And so, which is good. I mean, there's better food and there's better bike lanes and you know, all the stuff that that I've grown accustomed to on the West Coast is now spread, I think, across the whole United States. Not just, I think most of the big cities are starting to catch on for that kind of lifestyle.
Now, are you going by the same name that you went by when you lived here there?
I'm going by Luke Skywalker now.
That's good. I'm actually, I think Will and I need to come out and visit you.
Yeah.
We may do a workshop. I don't want to throw this out there too formally, but we may do a workshop in Nashville that's live with all three of us.
I get the guest house.
You do get the guest house. Jake gets the hotel.
Wait, why? Oh, because...
I'm just kidding. You can have the guest house, too. I have a guest house now, and you guys can all be in there with your whole families. It'll be 20
people. Because I don't want to be there with
Will. Do you sound like a jerk saying that? Do you feel like a jerk at all saying that?
The guest house?
Yeah.
About the guest house? No, only if I started commenting on how much you can drive the golf cart. I think I'm kidding.
Man. Okay, Jake, what are you working on?
So this month has been so busy. I've either been out of town or had a big project every single weekend. Like I told Allison, I said, do you realize in June, you do not get a Saturday with me at all. And so that's let's see, what did I do? I did a Comic-Con in Denver. I did a conference up in Boise. I did a workshop here at our studio, a day-long power day is what I called it. And I forget what was the other. Oh, we were supposed to record that class one of the Saturdays, but that fell through. So I ended up working on the children's book that I'm working on, which is Snowplow 2. Still working on that. And Skyheart is at the printers in China. This printer that I'm working with doesn't have like an office in the U.S., so the there's a little bit of translation, I think, issues happening, and it's been a little hard to communicate, which has slowed the project down a bit, but the price is just right, so I'm willing to deal with it. We'll see when the books get here if they printed them in black and white or color.
All right, what are we talking about this week?
All right, yeah. So this week is Will's topic.
I thought this was your idea, Lee.
No.
Don't look this way.
So let me just introduce this, because my two companions here don't have a whole lot of faith in this topic, but I think it's going to be fun. So the idea is basically, how do children's book awards and comic book awards fit into the professional illustrators? Maybe into their marketing plan, into how they develop their art,
and their career.
And basically, just kind of talk about, are they a factor? Aren't they a factor? Basically, everything you might want to know about these kinds of awards, and just kind of dive in and see what we come up with. So, yes, it is a gamble, but I love this subject. So, you guys. This podcast can only be good with your support, okay, you guys?
We'll do our best. Before we go any further, are you...
I like awards. I'm going to throw awards. That out there. I'm crazy
I'm
that way.
You on that.
It's controversial.
Before we go any further, Will, though, are you seriously going to wear the sunglasses the whole time?
I am. I have
I thought
to.
It was just
I'm
a joke.
I'm trying to throw you off your games, you guys.
All right.
I think the podcast is going to Will's head with these sunglasses.
Okay, so we're going to dive in. So if you are listening to this and you know, maybe you're new to illustration, and maybe you've been here for a long time, been an illustrator for a long time, and you probably know a lot about the awards we're going to talk about, you'll probably learn something new. Or this might actually open up an avenue. It might actually open up some thinking that you hadn't really factored into how you're developing your art. So the first question I would ask, well, do you guys think we should talk about the awards first and then talk about the, you know, like how?
Yeah, let's throw out some examples of what kind of awards we're talking about.
Let's do that.
What are the major awards, Will?
So the two that I really want to talk about are the Caldecott Award and maybe the Eisner, maybe the Newbery. I guess that's three. And just let people understand. And I think we mentioned this actually in a previous podcast. We glanced on awards just briefly, that they can be life-changing. And that for the people that win the bigger ones, their career is never the same. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to kind of talk about this.
So tell us, what is the Caldecott, what's the Newbery, and what's the Eisner?
Okay, so we'll start with Caldecott. Caldecott is an award that was actually conceived in 1937 by Randall Caldecott. And without going into the boring history on all of this, it's the awards that the Caldecott and the Newbery. Newbery is given to young adult fiction. Caldecott is given to the most distinguished picture book, and the Eisner is given to in the comic book industry for the I don't know much about the Eisner. I was hoping to get that from you, Jake.
Yeah,
is it to the best? What is the charge of that award?
It's sort of like the Academy Awards, but for comic books instead of for films. So there's a bunch of different categories you can win an Eisner in. So it would be like the best, overall publication. It could be like best writer, best artist, best letterer, best short story, best single series, or, best publication for kids.
So there's a lot of different Eisners given out.
Yeah. So there's probably 20 different categories, maybe 30 different Eisner Awards.
Is it just maybe we're going to go into this later, so I don't want to jump the gun, but is it just a trophy kind of thing like the Oscars, or is there anything that comes with it, like a publishing gig or something?
No, usually what happens, it's an award that you get, a trophy, and then a sticker goes on your book, says it won an Eisner, and then that's the extent of, I guess, what the Eisners actually award out. The publishers, though, love it because their book wins an award and they get to put the sticker on it and they get to push it as an Eisner award winning book. And also, the creator who won the award now has a bargaining chip for their next project.
Hmm. Yeah. So these different awards, we're probably not talking about Newbery, although that's also given out by the American Library Association. Think about one of the most interesting things for me about thinking about this award and the librarians and all that give it out. When I was in school, I hated school growing up. And the last thing in the world I ever thought I would go to is a librarian convention. In fact, me and two of the guys that I went with, illustrators, one was Guy Francis and Nate Hale, we started playing a game of Can You Spot the Librarian? So whenever we were out, not in at the convention, but in a restaurant or in an elevator, we would just say, excuse me, are you here for the conference? We would first yes or no,
What was your success rate?
It was pretty low. Librarians come in all different shapes, sizes, colors, and
nice. So we're dispelling the kind of nerdier side.
Definitely, none of them
had
the little chains on their glasses, But that's the last thing I ever thought I would go to is an ALA conference, and I've been to three of them now, and it's where illustration, your children's book illustration, and librarians collide, I guess. There's this, there's this definite connection, and I just never saw myself ever caring anything about what a librarian thinks. And now, of course, as a children's book illustrator, you have to care what librarians think because they're the ones that recommend your book or not, And so some illustrators really pander to librarians. But anyway, the Caldecott is the most, it's by far the biggest award that's given out for children's books. So we've talked about the Eisners for comic books, and there are probably a lot of people listening that are doing different types of illustration, and there are probably other big awards that we're not going to really talk about too much in this. But I would imagine that what we're going to say about these awards would probably cross over into other markets as well. Now, the Caldecott, I'll just kind of go through some of this stuff just to kind of give a little history.
Wait, you haven't told us what the Newbery Award is.
I did. I touched on it just a little bit. It's for young adult fiction.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So if it goes to writers,
it goes
not
to writing. Yeah, it's a writing award.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. An interesting thing about the Caldecott Award is that it's given out from a committee of 15 people, and most of those, eight of those are appointed positions – from the ALA, which is the American Library Association, and their librarians. The other seven are appointed or not, or voted on, and they are usually also librarians, but they could also be school teachers. And so it's interesting that this art award is being given out by non-trained artists or not artists, right? They're librarians primarily.
I would say, is it the only art award that
isn't judged by artists? Probably.
Yeah, isn't judged by artists.
Yeah.
Because they're judging it, the book as a whole, not just as an art piece,
right?
But as a story.
They're not supposed to.
As an experience, right?
They're not supposed to judge the story. And that was another thing that I wanted to talk about is what's interesting is, so it's only supposed to be given out for the art. They're only supposed to consider the art. However, to my knowledge and from what I've seen, there's never been a Caldecott book selected with a really poorly written story. And as librarians, I don't think that you could allow yourself to give that award to great art and a bad story. And personally, I wish that the charge was for both.
So on the Wikipedia page, it says that the medal is for distinguished illustrations in a picture book and for excellence of pictorial presentation for children. And then it says components other than illustration should be considered as they bear on effectiveness as a children's picture book. So other components like...
But definitely not story.
The story. So it is a story.
It should be. Now, I've always heard that their charge is, you're just supposed to be, like when we had Gene Nelson on our third Thursday thing, and he said that too. He said, that's the charge that you're given as a, he's been a committee member twice.
So he's judged for the Caldecotts twice now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And, a lot of my information comes from him actually, and from Carla Morris, who's also a friend of mine and another person who served on the Caldecott committee 1 year. They're supposed to award, like you said, they're supposed to give this award to the most distinguished picture book. What does that mean? What does distinguished mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll leave that to the judges.
Well, the definition that I got off of Google is successful, authoritative, and commanding great respect.
Okay.
So it's basically still doesn't tell you anything. Like,
it's pretty vague. But is there, talking about the writing and the illustrating mixed or being separated, is there, the first thing I start to think about when entering contests, is there a way to game the system? And so I look for consistencies. I don't know why I think that way. I actually looked up how to win at Monopoly the other day. So there is, I didn't think there was any true technique to Monopoly, but there is. Anyway, it's a side note. So if you play me in some kind of game and I get a chance to research, I'm probably going to have some kind of statistical advantage. So
I can vouch for that because when you took me to play Frisbee golf, I could see your gamesmanship coming out.
I can't help it. I'm a twin, and so it's
don't ever play Frisbee golf.
So when I look at, say, 2000, all the way to present, how many of them, without looking, would you guys say are written and illustrated by different people?
I think I looked this up once a while back, and I think the more recent books are almost all single people,
writer-illustrator combo.
Writer-illustrator combo.
I would
combo.
Say it's 75% writer-illustrator combos.
I think it's a little higher. I don't have a percentage, but it's since 2000, four of them have been written by someone else.
Oh, wow.
So since 2000, you're saying 14 of the books were done by one person. They wrote it and they illustrated.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, so I mean that's a little bit more than a random statistic at that point. Yeah. Wouldn't you say?
So if you want to, so step one to winning a Caldecott is don't work with a writer.
These are actionable items that we...
Well, what's interesting...
me and
an interesting thing about that is, and I've heard editors talk about this, is they really like to promote a person. And it's harder for them to physically send two people around. You know, And I think that translates down to the committees too. I think they really like to celebrate this one person. They really do treat if you win this award, you are the Miss America of the children's book world for a year. You know, you hold the title and you are treated as such.
Is there a swimsuit aspect to winning the award too?
They took that away.
Oh, okay.
They used to.
Oh, if so, Lee's totally a shoo-in this year.
I just got my Speedo. What do you mean there's no...
Oh, man. So, yeah. So, you know, this kind of jumps the gun. One of my questions was, can winning these awards change your life? And I think for many illustrators, especially winning the Caldecott... Now, there are over 200 children's book awards, and most of them, I would say... almost all of them would not be life-changing. And we talked about this in the other podcast. I've won like 5 different awards from different states. So almost every state has at least one award. And you get a little seal printed on your book. I won the North Carolina Book Award 1 year. And it wasn't anything that I even knew I was up for. My publisher entered all these different award competitions with books, which means they had to physically send out those books to be considered.
Yeah, it's a full-time job for a publisher to submit for all these awards.
It's a lot of work. And that's
so each state has their award, and one of my books won an award in Minnesota. But there's even as specific as like there's an award here in Utah for like if you're a Mormon illustrator, there's an award that they give to like best Mormon illustrator. You know, so it could be like as narrow and as specific as that.
That one's life changing.
Yes, it is. Huh?
So, tons of different awards. And, but if you were to win the Caldecott, and I don't know about the Eisners, I know the Newbery is like this as well, that will stay with you for the rest of your life. You will always be introduced as Caldecott winning, award winning illustrator, so and so. Mm-hmm. Your books will stay, that book and most of your other books will stay in print for the rest of your life. And that translates to a ton of money. For instance,
go ahead. If you're going to give it, I've got a specific example, but it sounds like you...
Well, yeah, I was going to say that there are over 200 libraries, I believe in the U.S., 200,000 libraries in the U.S., but between colleges, and all the
school libraries,
from elementary schools through high schools, private and public libraries. There's somewhere, what I heard at the ZALA conference is that there's somewhere around 200, and that could be worldwide. I could have that wrong. It could be worldwide, but there are, you know, just,
you there's know, more libraries than Starbucks.
I don't know if that's
and
true.
And every one of these libraries,
they open another library right on the corner from this last library.
But they all will stock the Caldecott Award winners.
Yeah, you got it. What kind of library doesn't?
It's a safe bet for them, and it will be forever. I mean, if you guys think about how movies work, you know, the Academy Award winners are the ones 50 years from now. That's the ones that still have, there's a list still, like, oh, go, you know, Academy Award winners, and it stays on the list, whereas everything else drops away in history, you know? And so I think it's a safe bet for librarians, and it's also a safe bet for bookstores to just say, hey, here's the one that's won award. They don't even have to vouch for it, really, because there's already this built-in approval system from the stamp on the front of the book.
It would be a cool list to make, to pull librarians across the country and ask them, you know, let's do a top 100 books in the last century that were not Caldecott winners. And that'd be interesting to see.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even know a book before 1995.
That's probably true. Okay. How about this century? the 21st century?
Librarians are going to write in and they're going to kill me. I know that librarians know books before 1995. One of my the artists that was signed with my agent, my previous agent, had won. Not he didn't win the Caldecott, but he got a runner up. And it was a was say it that again, Will. You cut out a little bit. Yeah, exactly. Caldecott honor. And so I was asking just some kind of rough numbers of what that means. And this is still, you know, just a couple years out from winning it, but significant enough where it's not still a new book in print, like 4 or 5 years old. And they're getting about $75,000 per year in royalties from that book still.
Wow.
But so that's an honor book, right?
That's an honor book. Yeah, it didn't even win.
So that brings up this. So with the committee, they basically, they choose the Caldecott and then they choose there actually isn't a number, believe it or not. They can assign as many honor books as they want. The committee that assigned the most 1 year was 5, and the fewest is 2. And a lot of years they've done 2. There's a lot of years that have done 3, 4, and I think only 1 or 2 years they've done 5.
Yeah, since I've been paying attention, it's been like 4.
Yeah, and the committee members will say they don't want to dilute the award, so they like to. They would never want to go more than, you know, 5, I guess. But anyway.
Yeah. I have another actionable item, by the way, on winning a Caldecott. So the first one is, you know, write your own books. Mm-hmm. Number 2 is be John Classen. Okay. Looking at the recent years, if you're John Classen, you will win one. If something
you went to school, John, right?
No. He came up to Portland to work on Coraline for Leica.
Oh, that's right. That's how you knew him.
So that's how I know him. Chris Appelhans was also one. I went to school with him. But John is the coolest guy ever. So if there's anybody who should win a bunch, it's him. Because it never goes to his head. He's the most humble person in the world. Nice. But he won a lot of them.
Yeah, his I Want My Hat Back. That one, an honor, I believe, right?
No, that got the
was
full
the
deal,
full,
and then the next year he got two like.
Fish one.
Well, I think he got the for This Is Not My Hat. He got the actual one that was in 2013, but then he also got the runner up book that year too. Yeah.
Crazy! And
can you imagine that call? Is they call you and they tell you that 2 of your books won?
I can't imagine. So, doing a little bit of numbers, a little bit of math. If there are 200,000 libraries. And from what I understand, the popular books that get checked out are getting replaced every year. So a lot of times they'll have between anywhere from 3 to 10 of a popular book that's getting checked out a lot at a big public library. So for instance, you know, our librarian here says sometimes they'll buy 10 of one Caldecott book if it's a really popular one. And they'll replace that every year. So that one library is buying 10 a year. For a while anyway. So the numbers, you know, if you figure you win the Caldecott, there's 200,000 libraries, they're each going to order at least one, and some are going to order 10 or and other numbers in between, and then they're going to buy them every year. If you're getting $1, $1.50 a book, you can do the math on that. It gets pretty insane pretty quickly, and that doesn't count for all the teachers that buy that collect Caldecott books, all the parents that collect Caldecott books that buy them. So it's life-changing.
It's exponential.
I've also heard that most publishers will give you a contract for your next 2 or 3 books when you win the Caldecott. Because they have to lock you in, because if they don't, someone else will. And they can sell you as the Caldecott, from a Caldecott winning illustrator so-and-so.
Yeah,
for your next books.
Do you guys have the Caldecott clause in your book contracts? Have you ever seen those?
I do have them in some of them. I can't remember
it's
what it
basically,
is. What's it
well,
in
it's
yours?
It's basically like if this book wins an honor, you get an extra $10,000 or $15,000. If it wins the actual Caldecott award, we'll pay you an extra $30,000. So, you know, and it's all, I think, percentage of what the advance was or something like that. So, you know. You get a bonus too.
Yeah.
Well, here's my critique of this though. And maybe this again is premature. So let me know, Will, but what do we do? I mean, like we're talking about it like it's an attainable thing, but I almost view it as a lottery win can you do something for it, or should you do something for it, or is that where we're going next?
Yeah, I felt like we would end up going there eventually, and now's probably just as good a time.
Yeah, so read through your questions about exploring this topic, Will.
In order.
Yeah, no, I'm just, yeah, just yeah, take
should
it
you
there.
Go, should you go after it? So my let me ask you guys this. Do you think that it's ever a good idea to change your art for other people? Because in order to go for this award, you'd have to basically do that, right?
If you're
not really. Well, how do you gear it for that though? If you look at the last 10 that won Caldecott's, they're so different. Like one of them's scratchboard and one of them's John Klassen's kind of flat style. One of them's, you know, Jerry Pinkney's watercolor or whatever, you know, it's
okay,
all over
the
place.
The
so
question,
which one do you
then
pick?
Another question would be, is every book or every story, could every story possibly be a Caldecott winner?
No.
So no. That's where I'm going. That's why I'm saying, should you change what you're doing to be, fit in the subset of Caldecott award winners?
Right. So there's two kinds of books that the children's book world publishes. And there's the award-winning books or books that they put out there that's clearly like, this is a book for, you know, the award. And then there's books that are put out there that are like, this is just to sell a ton of books. So on one hand, you would have something like, I Want My Hat Back, mm-hmm. which, you know, is artsy, right? And then on the other hand, you have Fancy Nancy. Is Fancy Nancy ever going to win a Caldecott?
No.
No.
And why not?
And yeah, that's the question. Why not? It's not distinguished. Or is it distinguished? I don't know. One of them is definitely playing towards a particular market.
You're about to disparage Fancy Nancy, aren't you?
I'm not disparaging. It's a fine set of books. We could.
I don't know what Fancy Nancy
look
is.
Look that up.
And I'm looking it up right now.
Very extremely successful.
Extremely successful
from a commercial standpoint.
But it's a commercial book, and it's not designed to win an award. It's not designed to, you know, it's not very literary.
Why can't the books that I like win an award?
I don't know. You should make the Will Terry Award
for equivalent
stupid books. Sorry.
So this is the equivalent of like in the music industry, like a boy band. Like they're not trying to be a great, you know, jazz musician or something. They're trying to. It's just like a lowest common denominator kind of book that's going to sell a million of them, but there's not much substance there.
Exactly. And then you have the books that I think bridge the gap a little bit. So, what's her name? The pig that dresses up as a ballerina.
Olivia.
Yeah, Olivia. So why am I going to think of that? I have it right here on my bookshelf.
Falconer. If you want to, you guys want to look it up, Ian Falconer.
Yeah, so Olivia is an award-winning, I think Caldecott-winning book, right? Or an honor, at least. And then it's gone on to be extremely commercial. And there's all these different...
It's a franchise
Olivia's
now.
Spinoffs and Olivia board books and then the Olivia cartoon,
it's crazy.
Stuffed animals. And so that was like a backdoor way into being commercial, like going through.
And the backstory on Ian Falconer, I don't know if you knew this, but he did not set out to be a children's book illustrator. So,
no.
So his thing was he was trying to become a famous gallery artist. And he just happened to go to the right party in New York where there was a children's book editor from a big publisher there. And he made a big splash. Apparently he's you know, the party guy, the kind of the loud guy at the party. And somehow he got her attention and showed her some sketches. And she saw that little pig. And she says, "What's this?" "Oh, it's just something I've been kind of doodling." "Well, have you ever thought of doing children's books, being an illustrator?" "No." So he wasn't even trying to be an illustrator. And
say those are the stories that annoy everybody. Don't say that story.
She said, "Well, there's a story about this pig. You need to write the story about this pig." And so she helped him write the story and the rest is history. But if you look up Olivia on Google and hit images, the merchandising is amazing. The number of books.
So I honestly feel like to win a Caldecott is half of it is you have to be really good at your craft, right? You have to make a pretty darn good book. I think the other half is you have to be known by people. Like, I don't think if you look at that list of Caldecott winners, how many of them are their first book?
A lot.
Most of them are people that have been around for a little while. The librarians are familiar with them. They like what they're doing. Like, look at Peter Brown, right? Look at Dan Santat. Look at who else? Jerry Pinkney, Brian Floca. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, but a lot of them. I thought you were going in a different direction with this. A lot of them are kind of no-name people that kind of came out of nowhere.
Who? Find one for me.
Now, I could be wrong, but what about Beth Kramis? She did the Scratchboard one. Maybe like 7 or 8 years ago. The House.
I don't know her history. Yeah, I remember it. That was a nice book. I don't know her history, though.
What about Brian Selznick?
The rest of them, though, I agree with Jake.
With Hugo Cabret.
He wasn't a beginner by any stretch.
Even if this is their first children's book, I feel like they're known in the circles that are choosing.
You're probably right.
You know, so I think there's like maybe like a networking or a political aspect to it too. Like maybe they're not well known, but the editor that they're working with is well known. You know, and they trust that editor or the publisher. Is well known, and they trust that publisher or the agent that they're working with. Like, the agent may be well known and signed up this, you know, hot new creator, and so there's like some things that precede that. Like, I don't think you're going to self publish a book and have that win a Caldecott, or I don't think you're going to do a book from a small publisher and have it win. I think
definitely not. I would definitely agree with that.
It's coming from.
Well, I mean, if you look at like Dan Santat before he won for The Adventures of Beagle, which is an awesome
book,
and Dan's a really cool guy. He's like a keynote speaker at all the bigger SCBWI stuff. Everybody knows him. And then he didn't win like 1 or 2 years before, maybe it was the year that John Klassen won, 2013, where he was kind of passed over in a sort of surprise way. And this is the grumbling. I have no idea if any of this is, you know, true without talking to the judges. But there was kind of a sense that he should have gotten something and kind of didn't. And then so was maybe owed a little bit. I mean, I don't want to phrase it like that because it sounds like they just would have given it to him no matter what. He made a beautiful book, which did deserve it, I think.
I thought his last book deserved it too. And I thought that one was even better.
Heck yeah.
That was amazing. After the fall.
I thought that was a shoe-in. I thought that was a shoe-in to at least get an honor. Yeah. Did it not? I can't remember.
I don't think it did.
What does Wikipedia say?
I didn't look at the full list this year.
It was an amazing book.
It was a great book. Yeah. And he's just kind of, I think he's found his stride with storytelling. But to go back to Jake's point, I think everybody knew him and he was making the rounds. He wasn't just kind of a wallflower that just won this thing out of the blue.
You know, that's step three. Are we on step three?
We're on step three.
I think step three is, okay, so step one is don't hook up with a writer.
Right, write your own thing.
Step two.
Hey, you can't say it like that.
Don't say it like that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Don't partner with a writer.
There you go.
Okay. Step two. What was our step two? The swimsuit thing?
Be
John Klassen. Step three is speak at SCBWI conferences.
Like, how do you do that?
You call everyone and just say, I'm available. Here's my fee.
Hey.
I love like finding a person who's won it and just backtracking, like, okay, what's every step that led?
Figuring out,
you know, every one of these people has a different path.
I mean, it is like it's interesting. I know one of the reasons why you were hesitant to want to talk about this, Lee, is because it's like lightning striking, right? I mean, let's be honest. You can't set your career on a path where eventually it leads to you winning the Caldecott. Like that's like there's a lot of people that are trying to do that, right? Wouldn't you say? And that still have never won a Caldecott, right? Like the three of us.
Yeah. It's true. But I do have a true actionable item on here. And what I think, if you look at another consistency here, is of course the quality is really high. And I think these people who are illustrating these particular books and writing them too, since most people are writer illustrator, I think the big component is they believe in the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of people will take a job because, oh, I got to pay my rent and here's a job. And so I'm just going to go ahead and do it. And then it doesn't really move you forward in a way that's meaningful. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, one real takeaway I think is do meaningful work. And I think that gets you closer to this. Mm-hmm. You know, whether the lightning is going to strike on you, maybe, or maybe not, but at least you can believe in the work.
Yeah. I think if you are getting into the children's book illustration world or that's a goal of yours, I think you've got to decide what is the type of creator you're going to be and what best fits your personality and what you want to work on. So, you know, are the stories in you like, I just want to tell a story of, you know, a character finding themselves and I'm doing it through this like, you know, artistic way, or it could be, you know, a lot of the winners are bio pieces where it's like they find a person that might have been overlooked in history and they do a biography of them, or it's someone that you're familiar with, like the Winnie the Pooh book mm-hmm. that won. You know, you're familiar with Winnie the Pooh, but you're not familiar with how that character came to be. And so this person did a children's book all based on that, you know? So if that's where you're more literary in your approach to your craft and in the stories you want to tell, then lean into that and really do like follow your muse and believe in that. But if you're more like, oh, I just want to tell stories about like aliens who abduct parents and the kids, you know, take over the neighborhood. And those are the children's books I want to write. Then go all the way with that and have that be your thing. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to win an award to be successful, and you don't have to be a New York Times bestseller to be successful. You could find your audience, and you could find the people that are into what you're doing. I attend that conference that I attended to a couple weeks ago. Casey Neistat spoke at it, and he's this YouTuber, popular YouTuber, you know, really influential in that world. But he was speaking to us as a creative, two creators. And one thing that he said that really stuck with me was he said, do the thing that you love to do and that you're good at, and just wait for the world to catch up to you, because mm-hmm. eventually they will. If the thing that you love to do is unique enough and you're really good at it, eventually people will discover you and they're going to love it. And you'll find your audience.
So I think totally believe in that. I, to go along with that, I attended the ALA where Brian Selznick accepted his Caldecott for Hugo Cabret. And if you look at that book, a lot of people were saying there's no way it could win. It was on the radar. Mm-hmm. And when I say on the radar, there are popular editor blogs and librarian blogs where they'll give their choices for Caldecott.
Right. Right.
So before the Caldecott is awarded in the midwinter conference, they'll just put out their short list of what they think the Caldecott could be picked from.
And they're trying to influence the judges. Right?
I think they probably are.
Do you think it
well,
works?
His was talked about a lot that year, and it created a lot of controversy because I think a lot of children's book illustrators felt threatened. That, hey, you know, because Hugo Cabret is a graphic novel. And I think a lot of children's book illustrators felt a little bit like, hey, this is our award. You know, go get your Eisner or something. Or, you know, even though the Eisner's not for the graphic novel, right?
Yeah. No, Eisner's is for graphic novels.
Graphic novels and comic books.
But Hugo Cabret was literally a novel with tons of illustrations in it.
Right.
So
then they're like, well, go get your Newbery somewhere else. But
yeah.
But I like there were people that were upset that it won the Caldecott and I guess the point that I wanted to make going along with what you were saying is, you know, Brian he went for it. I mean, like, if you look at the volume of work in that book, it's insane. It's absolutely, and he had to make 3 trips to Paris to get more reference. And each time he would talk to his publisher and say, I need to go back over. And they were totally behind him. And they actually believed, and he talked about this in his acceptance speech, that they believed in him and thought that he had a serious chance at winning this award. Publishers will really get behind books that they think could win this award because it means huge profits for them. Huge.
I will say, I mean, that one book, though, to be fair to the illustrators who felt that way, not that I don't think it's a beautiful book, because it is, but I'm looking through all of the ones that won the Call the Cut, you know, 40 years worth right now, and on the ALA website. And that's the one that if you have a child, you know, I'm lucky I have a 7-year-old right now, so I'm right in the middle of all this, you know, reading these books and stories, and half of them are books that I bought just for myself. Half of them are stuff that I check out the library for him. That's the one that I can't read for him out of all of every single one on this list. It's the one you can't read to your child for the most part.
Yeah, it's very different, and it was very controversial. I'll tell you another story real quick. Our one of our friends that we have in common who was on the Caldecott committee said that one of the years that this person was on the committee, there was huge, half of the committee was really mad at the book that won. They were really upset. And in fact, one of the committee members wouldn't come to the dinner, the final award ceremony dinner. He was just so disgusted at the book that won. And the reason I bring that up is because if I think it is a fool's errand to go after this award, right? Because it can hinge on something as simple as, you know, half the committee doesn't even want your book, the book that won, to win. That might have been the book that took the Caldecott away from your book, you know. So even the committee's not totally behind it. And I've there's another thing called a mock Caldecott where, have you guys ever participated in one of those?
No, but
I've had a couple of books that have won.
Yeah, so basically a mock Caldecott is just groups of interested people getting together and going through a simplified process of selecting books and then voting on them and then seeing which one their group would select. And I did that once with a friend with two friends, and we found that just the faction of 3 among the 15 in the group, we could actually throw a vote away knowing the count from previous votes. It's kind of confusing, but basically we could see which one had won the number one slot before. And we saw that our second pick was almost not in the running for an honor book. And so instead of voting for the number one book again, I think the number one book had like 10 votes. So we said, if the 3 of us don't vote, put our weight behind the number one book, and we put our weight behind this, our second choice, we might be able to move it into the honor book category. And we did. And no one could figure out how did so many people flop all of a sudden and get this book in there? And then we told them afterwards, we were like, well, we saw that this one was going to make number one. And so we just gambled and we threw our votes behind this other one. So there's things that can happen behind the scenes.
Did I tell you about?
I like
did
that.
Did I tell you about the? I went to receive the award for the book in Minnesota, and the woman who was driving us around was a librarian who was working for this this award. But she was also last year or year before she was on the Caldecott committee, and I was like, "Oh, let me just tell me about that. What's it like? How'd you get on there? What was it like judging and?" And she said that they had so many books to read and to flip through. And mm-hmm. she's like, what it came down to was we got a short list from everybody. Everybody just kind of said, here's my short list of what I think we should do, what I think we should read. So that immediately like excluded all but 100 books, you know. And then she said, when it came down to is we're sitting here reading these books, and we're narrowing it down, and we're eliminating it, and all of them are so good that that it's not so much as which book is better, but what are the little things that are going to take this book out of the running. So it might be something as simple as there's no room on the cover for the sticker. Like, mm-hmm. this is a good book, but...
It's funny because illustrators actually joke about that. Like, and I've even designed in a blank space. Mm-hmm. You did that, didn't you, Jake?
I did that, yeah, for one of my books. But
I actually drew the Caldecott sticker on my as a placeholder. No, I'm just kidding. I haven't done that.
But yeah, if, you know, it's between two books. One has a beautiful spot to put a sticker, the other one doesn't, they're gonna go to that. But they were also looking at what's the paper it was printed on, what's the, wow. the finish, what's the artwork in the you know, on the overleafs and the end papers and things like that. You know, they're looking at everything. What's the font they used? And so you know, if it all comes together and just looks like it could be a Caldecott winner, it's more likely to win the award than, you know, one book that the cover just isn't quite there.
Another thing I've heard is that you have these highly influential people that have been appointed to the committee. And mm-hmm. I'm talking about, like, you know, head librarians for, you know, like mm-hmm. the New York City Library or something, you know, right. someone with a distinguished title.
Former presidents of the United States. Yeah.
And then you have a school teacher, right? Uh-huh. And if the head of the New York Public Library is also a very confident person who's, you know, let's face it, personality wise, people come in all different flavors, and some people are overbearing, and some people are really take charge type people. So I've heard several times where they've said in these committees, you'll have a couple loudmouths, and because of their position,
they can sway everybody.
Well, then the school teacher or the small town librarian who's also, you know, kind of a more meek person doesn't want to ruffle any feathers and will just go along with what these loudmouths are saying. So I guess in another sense, that's another reason why, you know, trying to do everything you possibly can to get this award is probably a fool's errand, right?
Right. I mean, yeah. Well, I want to go back to that list, our list of things you should do. And honestly, number two, be like John Klassen. Be like him in that he wasn't creating anything that had been done before. He was being himself.
Yeah.
And yeah. Honestly, if you're looking at the winners this year and you're like, okay, I'm working on my book and I'm going to see what won this year and kind of let that influence some of my decisions, you're going to be 3 years behind by the time your book comes out.
Yep.
You know, and really what I think what wins and what's favorable is going back to that quote is doing the thing that you do well and letting the world catch up with you and putting out something that's unique and could only come from you and letting people decide whether they like it or not. And, you know, it might not be Caldecott material, but you created the thing that only you could create.
It might be the Snowman at Night by Mark Biener, you know, who he's exactly. never won a Caldecott, but he had immense commercial success with that book series, Snowman at Christmas, Snowman at Night, Snowman at the Picnic. Or, you know, he's got so many of those. And he had done a lot of books with, you know, medium commercial success. And even to this day, he has no idea why that one took off. But, I mean, New York Times bestseller for many, many, many weeks. And the series is just, it's put his kids in college. It's just, you know, done really yeah. well.
I'd like to add to the list, which kind of talks about what you were talking about, Jake, the little things. Design matters quite a bit. And so if you're going to be somebody, I mean, I get students like this all the time that really want to just show that they can illustrate everything. And so every little corner gets illustrated. Not that you shouldn't put the things you think should be in there, but having a good sense of graphic, I always say graphic design trumps illustration. And I know that rubs people the wrong way a lot of times. But good design matters. And like, if you look at somebody who's a great painter, like, Chris Van Allsburg. I mean, he's a great illustrator, very classical, but he's a great designer first, in my opinion. His pieces are just gorgeous as designs. And that stuff holds weight, obviously, if you leave room for the type to breathe, you know, where somebody, the designer's not trying to shove it in some little corner because you over-illustrated. The whole package mm-hmm. matters, and so maybe that's a takeaway as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you look at, you know, especially Klassen and even even Dan Santat too. They all have that graphic design sense, and most of these guys are also doing the actual like title design. You know, it's mm-hmm. their handwriting, or it's their like version of type design that they've hand done. So
I think
that's a good takeaway. Was there anything else you wanted to add about this, Will?
No, I just think that I think it's something that's important for people to be aware of, for illustrators to be aware of, that this is a whole world out there that you may not know about. And if you are writing a more, I hate to use the word arty because it's just so vague, but I mean, the Caldecott winners, they are unique. I think you could definitely say that. They're very diverse. They're very unique. They're definitely, I would say in general, the messages that the stories have are messages of self-empowerment, messages of inclusion. They're
discovery.
They're not like what you said earlier, the fancy Nancy. They're not the you know, this is my truck in the sand kind of book, you know, and this is my bulldozer, and again, not typically a list book, you know. More of a story book or about a political figure, something along those lines. So if you feel like you fit in, then maybe there are small alterations that you can make to make sure that you're at least in the running.
Yeah.
But in general,
you know, this is a podcast I wish I had heard 10 years ago as I was getting into illustration. Illustrating children's books and leaving animation, I didn't know anything about the Caldecott. I'd seen the stickers on the books before, but that didn't mean anything to me. I didn't even think, oh, this is a good book. I just, you know, it was just something. It was just, I don't know,
right.
Adornment, right? And so discovering what the Caldecott was and discovering how the publishing world works definitely like steered me for some of my projects and helped me understand. So I feel like someone listening to this, if they're new to illustration, they're new to the children's book publishing world, like here's your primer on awards and how they work, specifically the Caldecott. I also feel like this episode is just, this is the kind of conversation that illustrators get together and just kind of talk about and throw things out and share stories and things like that. So if anything, if you had heard of the Caldecott before, you at least got, you at least got like shop talk.
My first introduction to this was I was sitting in a car. We were going to an event at a book signing event. And one of the ladies in the car had been on the committee. And she basically, we had this whole discussion and I was kind of new to children's mm-hmm. books, and I just sat in the back and just soaked it in, you know. So this is kind of that conversation, minus the experts that have been on the committee before. But yeah, I mean, it's important stuff to know, and I do know people who are, you know, trying to at least put themselves in the running for Caldecott, and, you know, maybe it will strike someday. There are definitely people who it's landed on multiple times, but it is life-changing. And so if you can figure out a way to at least make sure that you're in the running, I think that's a good thing. If not, don't worry about it. Just do your thing.
Well, there is a way to use kind of this as motivation too, anyway, like how I use the Caldecott going through school and then transitioning from school to working was I always thought it's so egotistical, but like I'm doing my first book and I'm like, okay, this has a shot at the Caldecott, you know, I'm thinking that in the back of my head. And I didn't really think that, I guess, but I was always just egotistical enough to think if it wins, I don't want to be embarrassed by anything in it. So I want to do like a better job. so I don't have to like be like, oh, I wish I would have rendered that page a little better or thought about the story a little bit better. So I just used it as like, is this Caldecott worthy? Was my and it, of course it wasn't. I wasn't a good illustrator at all.
That's a good point.
I think
yeah, because there's some spreads in some of my books where I just phoned it in, and if I had that mindset, it would have been like, okay, let's take a breather, come back to this spread,
maybe redo it,
or put in 100% on it and make it better. So before we close this out, let's go through Before you do that,
I got one more question for you guys.
Okay.
Have you ever waited up for the call?
No.
Set your alarm?
No. Nope. I didn't even know that's how it worked.
Okay, I did. It was embarrassing.
How it works is is after the judging's done, before they announce it, they call you to let you know that you won it.
And they meet all night.
Yeah, they meet all night and
the night before.
Which book did you think
so
you had it with?
I had the mistake of one of my authors who was connected with some high powered people, and I don't want to say who it was in the ALA. Our book that we did together, and I'm not going to say which one it was on the short list for getting an ALA reading list award. So she told me that she said, I just want you to know, don't get your hopes up, but I found out. I'm not supposed to know this, but our book is up for the ALA. She said list, but I didn't know what that meant. I interpreted that as Caldecott. So they announced the ALA also puts out a short list of books that they recommend that year when they announce the Caldecott. So my book was up for that. It wasn't up for the Caldecott, but I thought it was. So I set my alarm early in the morning because apparently they call you. And they put you on speakerphone and they tell you that way. So
yeah,
I was like,
I want them to reach my voicemail every time and I'm not going to call.
And a lot of committees have disappointing stories like that where the person, so ironically, there's a lot of illustrators who didn't even know, they literally did not know what a big deal Caldecott is. And so there have been stories of some illustrators getting woken up at 6 a.m. and then just hanging up like it's a crank call kind of a thing, right? Like they're just like, or being mad. Like, why are you calling me at 6 a.m? They don't understand how it's going to change their life financially, that they'll have a large income for the rest of their life without doing anything. You know what I mean? Like they don't even understand any of those ramifications.
Well, they don't put out a short list or anything, do they?
No, the ALA puts out a short list that has nothing to do with the Caldecott committee. But it's announced with the Caldecott. And so that's...
Okay, so nobody really,
no one
nobody
knows
truly
the books
knows
that
even
didn't
what that
make
short
the
list.
Honors. You know, like you have the Caldecott 2, 3, 4, 5 honors. You won't know the books right behind that. So you'll never know. Unless you are friends with a committee member who's willing to divulge, but they're not supposed to. They kind of swear an oath to that. And another really anecdotal story to go along with this is... I know a guy whose book was published by a small press, and winning the Caldecott was the most frustrating thing for him because his press could not keep up with demand. They did not understand the numbers. So they pretty much, from what I understand, they won't select books from small publishers anymore.
No.
At least they haven't since this one.
They ruined it for everyone.
Yeah. So what happened was this publisher,
great.
You know, the typical print run is 10,000. Well, the typical demand for a Caldecott book is, well into the hundreds of thousands of books the day it wins. So they had printed 10,000, then they printed an additional 50,000. By the time that those came available, they were gone. They printed another 100,000. Those were gone. And they could never keep up. So this poor illustrator was going to do all these book signings all over the country, getting flown around, and he never had his book to sign. Yeah,
oh,
so it was a
gosh.
Nightmare for him. His publisher never either. They didn't have the money. So the big publishers, I know this is like just extra information, but the big publishers have at least five different printers ready to go with a moment's call. They've clued them in on which books they think they could possibly win.
Yeah.
And they make
Get
sure
the printers
that they're ready.
Warmed up.
Oh,
get
yeah,
them ready.
And those big printers
wow.
are ready to handle the demand. They've already got it lined up. So
wow, that's
I'd like to revisit this topic around the time of the next Caldecott and see if we can pick it.
Mm. Yeah, we should try that.
We'll do if our own little mock Caldecott.
If we could pick 10 books and one of them is.
Let's put out our list of what we, how we think's gonna, maybe we should bet between us three, kind of have a pool going.
All right.
On who can get the closest.
And we could have the listeners bet on which one of us they think is going to win before they even know what our list is. Oh. Just from knowing who we are.
Remember what I said earlier about my research, everyone. Statistical advantage. <Right. laughs> Although Will sounds like he's the same way.
All right, to wrap it up, number one, take a look at your writing abilities and see if you could write stories that go along with your illustrations. Because I honestly feel like it's one thing to illustrate a book, and it's great what illustrators can bring to the word someone else writes, but I've done both. I've written and illustrated, and the books that I've written myself just have, there's just something about them that's a little bit more, like it feels like it's coming from like a purer place, right? Like it's something more unique and more original, maybe. I don't know if you guys feel the same way or not, but look and see if you have that in you to also write and draw your stories. Number two, be unique to you. Don't look at what everyone else is doing and just do what you're good at and find that, you know, find that thing that you can do and that you're passionate about. Number three, the details. Learn graphic design, learn composition, learn how to do the nice finished trim to things and finding the right font and just having an eye for the details. And I think number four? Let it drive you to create something really good, you know, even though you're not in the running or you may not ever be, but have that mindset to where if this was to win an award, you wouldn't want anything in there to embarrass you. So put your 100% into every aspect of it. So those are the takeaways.
Good, good.
All right. Where's my notes? All right. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where Becoming a Great Illustrator starts. There's over 70 different courses on svslearn.com that teach everything from how to draw everything to light and shadow to painting in watercolor to designing a book cover. And it's all available. Each class is available individually, or everything's available through the subscription, which is $30 a month. So check that out. Check out svslearn.com if illustration is something you're wanting to get better at. And your hosts have been Will Terry. You can find his work at willterry.com, and his Instagram account is at willterryart. Then we have Lee White. You can find his work at leewhiteillustration.com. And follow him on Instagram at Lee White Illo. Is that what it is? Yeah, okay. Yep. I thought so. It's been deleted from my notes, so I'm just going off of memory right here. And lastly, I am Jake Parker, and my website is mrjakeparker.com. And my Instagram account is at Jake Parker. And if you like this episode, please share it around. Tell everyone you know about what's going on over here at 3-Point Perspective. You could subscribe to it on iTunes that way, or on Apple Podcasts, and that way you always know when a new episode drops. And we love the reviews. We've been getting over 200 5-stars reviews at this time. So thank you so much, everybody, for that. Leave a review if you haven't done so already, because we'd love to hear what you guys think about everything. Lastly, if you want to join in on this discussion on the Caldecott, log on to the svslearn.com forum. Just go to the svslearn.com, click on forum, and there we have a thread posted about this episode. So chime in over there and let us know your thoughts. All right, thank you, everybody, and we will see you next time.